The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you feel our country favors Christians and discriminates against other religions. I'm sure you feel that way sincerely, my friend, but if you do, how can I put this? You are mistaken. It is Christianity under assault, and I'm going to discuss this assault later on in today's program, but first, you'll recall that 2 weeks ago, my guest was a Muslim apologist named Nadir Ahmed. We had a debate over the air. The debate has created quite a stir. And tonight, I want to debrief a little with my audience. I didn't do that last week because Lori Lewis was co-hosting the show with me. And when I have a co-host, I'd like them to pick their own topics and set our pace. Also, it was just nice to do a lighter show. It's always a fun show when we have Lori. And that's not that we don't talk about important things, but a lot lighter, a lot more fun. And it's good to do a fun one when you're following an intense one. But today, I am going to debrief the debate. And so I'm kind of leapfrogging back to 2 weeks ago. The topic of our debate was, is Islam a violent religion? My position was that although there are many peaceful Muslims in the world, and we must evaluate each and every Muslim on a personal basis, the Quran itself and the example of Muhammad himself really does command jihad. If you missed this program, it is posted to my website, bobsiegel.net. We're getting many, many, many downloads. The date was 3/11/12. Now, I want to explain why I decided to use a particular strategy during this debate. After opening statements and rebuttals, I inserted a discussion of Israel and the Palestinians during our Q&A. Some might think this was a tangent. In fact, I've not seen it come up often when Muslims and Christians debate. In fact, Muslims and Christians don't do a lot of debates, but when they have had them, I don't usually see Israel coming up a whole lot. I brought up Israel, and I brought it up for two reasons. Let me tell you exactly why I did it. Nadir stated at the beginning of the program that early Muslim battles were waged for the purpose of protecting Jews from Christian genocides. For that reason, I wanted to see how Nadir felt about the fact that many Muslims today do not recognize Israel's right to even exist. Another reason I brought it up, and this was the more important one, frequently when Muslim spokespeople are asked to renounce terrorism, the violence is obligatorily criticized, but then almost in the same breath, we hear something about Israel being just as much of a terror threat. For this reason, it seemed proper to correct some of the historical revision about the Middle East. All too often, Israel's quote-unquote occupation or something like America's oil interests are given as reasons for upbringings when truthfully, a lot of Muslims are committing violence because of jihad commands in the Quran. I know it's not politically correct to say that. What can I tell you? It's the truth. And I know it's common for people today to talk about the Middle East with this two-state solution between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and if only we had two states, everybody would join hands and sing kumbaya. No, it's not working that way, folks. In the debate, I reviewed some history, pointing out that in 1947, the United Nations created a two-state solution. The Jews accepted it. The Palestinians did not. They did not want a two-state solution. They wanted a one-state solution. That has never changed. Neither has the Palestinian Charter ever changed. The Palestinian Charter does not even recognize Israel's right to exist. They are not interested in sharing the land with Israel.
When Bob Siegel says that the Palestinians are unwilling to share the land with Israel, he doesn't mean to imply that they aren't willing to share any of the land.
Thank you, Dan. We always appreciate the special assistance of Disclaimer Dan.
Actually, the Palestinians only want the surface of the land. They are happy to bury just as many Jews as possible beneath the surface.
Several times during the debate, Nadir said I sounded hostile or angry. Well, I did speak quite passionately while listing some of today's Muslim atrocities, and next time I'm given such a chance in a debate, I promise to speak every bit as passionately. But I was feeling no anger toward Nadir, and neither did I say anything disparaging to him personally. He was treated with respect, and his discussion of my alleged anger seemed to me like a distracting ad hominem. That's a tactic used when people feel they are losing a discussion on points. They change the subject and say something personal about their opponent. Still, since Nadir raised the issue of hostility, I invite anyone who downloads this debate to listen carefully to Nadir dubbing me a terrorist worse than Osama bin Laden for using Bible prophecy to justify Israel stealing Arab land. He said it with a gentle, friendly voice, but his actual words should be noted. In fact, no mention was made of Bible prophecy by me. Not that doing so would be a demonstration of terrorism anyway. Instead, I spoke about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict purely from a human rights perspective with undisputed historical fact. The Jews did not steal Arab land. They were in the land for over 3,000 years before Arabs came in force to conquer in the name of Islam after the time of Muhammad. I do have some comments from listeners who heard the debate, and if you'll indulge me, I'd like to start by reading some comments from close friends. I'll read other comments, too. In fact, there's one guy who absolutely hated it. I will get to his, although his is so long. We may have to do his in a future week because he wrote a lot. In fact, I invited this guy. His name's Eric. I invited him to actually come on the show and debate me. He declined, but he wrote, quite a comment. And I'd like to at least address it over the air, but we may have to do it on a show where we can give it more attention. But in the meantime, when my own friends go out of their way to honor me, it's nice to show appreciation in return. This first one is from my friend Dave Spiegel. Dave Spiegel is a fellow Christian apologist and an excellent apologist. He and his wife listen to the show, and it's actually his wife that wrote me on Facebook on behalf of both of them. She says, "Amazing, Bob. Dave and I both listened and prayed for this debate. Love you, friend." Well, thank you, my dear friends. Now, Steve, interesting guy. He was a fellow high school student, very talented. Always got the leads in all of our musicals. We were both involved with the drama department. I graduated in 1972. Steve graduated 1 year later. Boy, I'm really dating myself, aren't I? I have not seen this guy for almost 40 years. But he found me through the wonders of the internet. He found me on Facebook, friended me. And then these past few months, he started listening to a lot of the radio shows, which, of course, I post on Facebook. But during the actual debate, Steve was listening live on KCBQ.com from San Jose. And Steve says the very same day of the debate, he writes me and says, "You did an awesome job on your show this evening. Very proud of you. You were brilliant." I am honored to hear such a comment from a past peer. And I'll tell you why. It's not to brag. It's not to brag. I know it sounds that way, but believe me, not to brag. As a matter of fact, it's because I was a real jerk in high school. I look back and can't believe some of the incredibly stupid things that came out of my big mouth. So it's nice when old friends meet the new Bob 4.0. Anyway, thank you, Steve. But of course, a comment is never more personal than when it comes from your own brother. My brother Paul took special interest in this debate because he's Jewish and he lives in Israel. He calls himself an Israeli now. And don't assume that simply because Paul's my brother, that means he automatically likes every radio show. My brother and I do not agree on everything. We certainly don't agree about Jesus. I say Jesus is the Messiah of Israel. Paul says otherwise, to put it mildly. But even when we do agree, Paul will critique style. He'll point out what I forgot to say or should have said. He pulls no punches and gives it to me between the eyes. In this case, however, Paul says, Thanks, Bob. Great debate. You did a great job of unmasking Islam. I can't believe how this guy was able to repeatedly say that Israelis, like me, who use the Bible to justify living in our land, are as bad as Osama bin Laden. Paul did express some concern, however. He saw through my opponent, but hoped others would do the same. He says, your opponent was good because he is good at sounding so reasonable, but he is still spewing out the same hate, just in a slicker, more Western-style package. I hope your listeners are able to tell the difference. Valid concern, Paul. How much hate he was spewing out, I don't know, but he was certainly spewing out a lot of error and a lot of words that people use to advance their hateful policies against the Jews. But Paul, be of good cheer, because my listeners are sharp as a whip. For example, Deb on Facebook, who listens to our show frequently, says, although Nadir Ahmed had the last word, he still didn't convince me. Great job, Bob Siegel. You know, that's true. This guy did have the last word because we gave it to him. That's almost unheard of on a radio show for a talk show host to give his opponent the last word. I know O'Reilly always tells his guests he's going to give them the last word, but usually he gets the last word anyway. But in a formal debate, it's not usual that the host won't make some comments afterwards. Before the debate, I did offer Nadir the choice of being the first or second to share an opening statement. He chose to go first, which is fine, but then towards the end, when it was time for closing statements, he asked if I could make the first closing statement since he had made the first opening statement. The moderator agreed. We did have Mike Friedenberg on moderating. He agreed, and I didn't object either. It happened so fast, but looking back, it seems kind of tricky because by Nadir making the second closing statement and the first opening statement, he ended up with the first word and the last word of the debate. Still, didn't matter. Deb says she was unconvinced by his arguments. Stan says, I heard your debate. He puts debate in quotes, meaning he didn't think there was much competition. I heard your debate with the Muslim guy. You trashed him. I can't believe that he can sincerely believe his own doctrine. I put you up there with Pam Geller, Robert Spencer, and Geert Wilders in helping to spread the word that these people are actually zombies. Well, I'm not sure I'd call them that, but anyway, this is Stan's comment. Stan continues, their religion actually keeps them down. If it hadn't been for oil money, the Muslims would not be a threat to the modern world. They would have stayed in the 7th century. Now Europe is almost taken over, and the First Amendment here may have a rider preventing criticism of religion. We probably both have fatahs against us. You know, he's right about a lot of this. Did you know that Hillary Clinton is working with the United Nations to try to get an international law passed that would make it against the law to speak against Islam? That debate that's on my website could be illegal soon. As for the fatahs on me and our friend Stan, who was kind enough to write us, I hope not, Stan. I sure hope not, but thanks for listening. I'm not going to back down either way, and I'm sure you won't either. Stay with it, my friend. Now, this is George on Facebook. George says, wow, clean sweep, Mr. Nadir, you lose. When talking about Islam, it is a history that goes back 1,400 years. When talking about the history of the Jewish state, it seems to only go back to the terrorist invasion, quote unquote, of the Arab lands. Unbelievably inept at debate. Bob, perhaps you could tie one hand behind your back next time. Well, thank you, George. Even though my audience isn't taken in by style or demeanor, I have to say that many Americans are. And we see it in our presidential elections. I just love listening to these focus groups that come on right afterwards and they talk about who won. Remember when Bush debated John Kerry back in 2004? We heard, Bush had a scowl look on his face. So clearly he lost. And in our present primary debates, 2012, when Mitt and Newt and Rick go at it, we hear, Mitt Romney looks the most presidential. Yeah, that's one of my favorites. He looked the most presidential. Gotta love it. People are going to the polls and voting for a president based on the same criteria with which they would choose toothpaste. It's a commercial. What they look like, who's handsome. Of course, these Republican candidates are challenging a Democratic president who was elected because of his charisma. And as president, Obama has this uncanny ability to go on TV and explain that he didn't just do what he actually did. After taking over certain banks and auto companies, he goes on TV to say he doesn't believe in big government. after refusing to accept the Canadian pipeline, then looking at his sinking numbers in the polls because of gas prices. He now says that he supports part of the pipeline. Yeah, the part that doesn't need his approval that would have been built anyway. Now he can still count on the support of his environmentalist voters while trying to fool everybody else. Oh, and he came on today and he says, you know, he was really all for studying this pipeline, but the Republicans were rushing him. Say, yeah, it's the Republicans that we blame now that that pipeline didn't get built. How does he say this stuff with a straight face? And yet people are buying it hook, line, and sinker. This guy's got a good chance of getting reelected. But the best when we talk about demeanor in a conversation or debate was when Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes interviewed Iranian President Ahmadinejad, a Holocaust denier who nevertheless announces that a Holocaust of his own is coming up. He doesn't believe the Holocaust happened, but it's not a bad idea. And as far as he's concerned, it will happen because he promises to wipe Israel off the map. And then I hear people after watching the interview with Mike Wallace call talk radio to say, well, the guy can't be all bad. He smiled a lot during the interview. Oh, he smiled. That's a relief. Well, golly, he smiled. Gee whiz, nothing more to discuss. Actually, we will discuss it. And who could explain smiling better than our own Smiley Miley?
Smile.
Hey kids, did you know that a lie detector is inadmissible evidence in a courtroom? Then how can police know when a suspect is lying? Here's a handy safety tip. If a man is smiling, he can't be lying. You see, if a man is smiling, it means he's happy. And everybody knows that happy people are good people. Nobody could be happy by being a criminal or an evil dictator or a deceitful president. Take the very first presidential debate between Nixon and Kennedy. Everyone who heard it on the radio thought Nixon won the debate. But those people were fooled. They only got to hear the words themselves. If they had seen the debate on television, they would have seen Kennedy smiling and Nixon sweating. Then they could have looked past the words and ideas to see the truth. They also would have seen that Kennedy was just plain better looking than Nixon. But being right because you're good looking is a topic for another day. The point today? There's no denying if a man is smiling, he just can't be lying.
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
Welcome back to our program. By now, it must be glaringly apparent that 2012's GOP presidential favorite is not going to be crowned anytime soon. With that in mind, I will offer some advice to all four contenders and their mutual rival, President Obama, as if any of them want my advice, need my advice, as if any of them even know who I am. But still, what kind of guy would I be? I, your old pal Bob, I am going to offer some advice to sober up all of our candidates. Now, like I said, the four GOP nominees and President Obama, so which means we have five candidates. Since I am critiquing everybody, I will undoubtedly draw fierce opposition from all directions. In an attempt to minimize the damage somewhat, Let me say from the outset that I will vote for any of the four GOP candidates who win June's nomination, even Ron Paul. Despite their relative strengths and weaknesses, each would be light years better than Obama, even Ron Paul. Yes, I felt the need to say that twice. Of course, such an appraisal falls slightly below adoration for the esteemed gentleman, because there are many names which sound better than Obama these days, including Bart Simpson, Yosemite Sam, and Tweety Pie there. And now I only have the Obama supporters mad at me, with perhaps a few Ron Paul supporters sprinkled in. So let's go down the list. Senator Santorum. Barack Obama will be challenging enough as a 2012 candidate. Please don't get off track by taking on John Kennedy at the same time. People liked that guy. As a matter of fact, you'd do well to avoid any tangent. Don't go chasing after controversy. Leave those fast-paced maneuvers to the dog in the Beggin' Strips commercial. And what the heck are you talking about when you say there's little difference between Romney and Obama? Are you serious? Have you lost your mind? I mean, you supported Romney in the last election. We haven't forgotten. Our memories aren't that short. We're not that stupid. I know you want the nomination. I know you want the nomination. This isn't the way to go about it. Go ahead and critique Romney. Critique his policy. Sure, that's appropriate. But Rick, stop the nonsense. I like you. I've defended you on the air. I've defended you in my column. But enough is enough, Rick. Now, Rick has walked that back a little bit. Rick, keep walking it back. Walk it way back. But let's be fair now. We move on to Governor Romney. It's time to let go of Romney care. We understand, we know the distinction you articulate between something mandated by the federal government or something mandated by the state. We've heard the explanation many times. Only one problem. It doesn't fly. Those who dislike large government do not sleep better at night simply because the state agency jams its big nose into their business rather than the federal. We realize another flip-flop is the last thing you need, but we'll make an exception on this one, Governor. Flip-flop. Flip-flop on Romney care. Then point out how you, of all people, know from experience that this kind of program is fatal to the future of our country. And that's what I have to say to Governor Romney. Let's move on. Speaker Gingrich. I have a little story to tell you, Mr. Speaker of the House. I remember years ago, while playing one of my favorite board games, Risk, a mutual agreement was made with my friend Al. The agreement was this: we would not attack each other until everyone else was out of the game. Unfortunately, there is no rule in Risk which insists that a player honor his agreements. Al double-crossed me. Al attacked me. I was shocked. I felt betrayed. As a reaction, my strategy shifted immediately. No longer was I playing to win. I was playing now to just take Al out of the game. Now, Mr. Speaker, nobody can read your mind, but just in case a similar strategy is all you have left, perhaps it's time to pack it in for the good of the party and the election. And Congressman Paul, since having a public forum is obviously important to you, consider talk radio or a cable TV show. You do have some good things to say, and you deserve to be heard, but please stop trying to accomplish this by running for president each election year when everyone knows your chances of winning are about as good as Sandra Fluke starting a write-in campaign for Rush Limbaugh or Bill Maher walking down the altar next Sunday morning after a heart-stirring message from a pastor in church. And that leaves us with President Obama. Mr. President, although I do not want you to win, here is the advice I would offer if I headed a re-election committee. Here's my advice. Don't debate Republicans on your record. In fact, just ignore your record and pray that everyone else does the same. Instead, turn Republican concerns into problems that do not truly exist. A good place to start would be this whole mess with the Catholic Church and contraceptives that you stepped in and couldn't scrape off your shoe. Since any thinking person understands the real issue is First Amendment religious freedom under assault and not birth control, you must appeal to emotions rather than facts. Transform it into birth control and nothing more. Keep describing this as a woman's rights issue. Make sure those involved in a healthcare contraception discussion hear about no position other than the missionary position. Maybe some of those thick-headed GOP candidates will take the bait and walk through a door they would have rather left shut. And who knows, as icing on the cake, perhaps some conservative talk show host will also shoot off his big mouth on the subject, and you can coast on the fumes of this controversy until November. Since anyone who drives is also coasting on fumes these days, you may as well establish some empathy. Oh, wait! Looks like somebody may have given President Obama similar advice already. Never mind.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back. Early in the program, I was debriefing my debate that I did 2 weeks ago, my debate with a Muslim apologist. Continuing now with comments about my discussion of Islam, offered both in that radio debate and a companion piece that came out that same week in my online Washington Times column entitled Forbidden Table Talk. Now, I told you, I was reading first some nice comments from my friends, and then I read some nice comments from people who I don't know as well, the regular listeners. But I told you that I would get to the negative ones. And if you're waiting for the negative ones, have we got a feast for you. Responding to my column, Begonia, I don't know where people get these names, but if I was making some of these comments, I'd change my name too. This person calls himself Begonia. Begonia says, I'm assuming this is a fringe publication, as I would not expect a major publication to print such racist drivel. Well, Begonia, this may come as a big surprise to you, but Islam is a religion. Islam is not a race. Not all Muslims are Arabs. Not all Arabs are Muslims. There are Muslims in the Philippines. There are Muslims in India. There are Muslims in Indonesia. There are white Muslims in America with European heritage, and they converted to Islam. And the fact that not all Muslims behave the same way was made abundantly clear in my article and in the debate. But your comment was almost accurate. Although the article wasn't drivel, one of the comments right underneath the article was drivel. And then Juvis says, and we were talking here in the article and on the debate, I mentioned the a few weeks ago when some Qurans accidentally got burned. Of course, the United States Army found that people were, some of the prisoners, some of the terrorist prisoners were writing messages in the Quran. So they went ahead and burnt them, not realizing evidently that that was anathema to Muslims to burn the Quran, but it was an accident. And then there were all kinds of riots and other Americans killed as a result of it. So I'm talking about that in my column. And Juvis says, it's not just about the book burning. The book burning was a catalyst to bring up other things they have been angry about. You know, when you argue with your spouse about what color the wall should be and he or she goes off and you are like, it's only about a stupid color. For him or her, it's the chance to go complain about all the other things in the relationship she is mad about. It's never just about the one thing. To say that these Afghans are rioting because of their holy books is just too simplistic. They are rioting about everything they hate about America being in their country. Oh, really, Juvis? So they're rioting about everything they hate about America, such as America liberating their country from the Taliban who used to cut people's hands off? Is that the kind of stuff they hate about America? Or could it just be that good old-fashioned jihad as commanded by Muhammad? Now, get a load of this name. This person calls himself Esther Haman. Now, I know Esther is a female name, but Haman is a male name. Why would somebody pick a nickname by a hyphenated Esther Haman? Well, that's because Haman was a biblical character, a Hitler-type person who lived in the days of Esther when she and the Jews were fugitives in Persia, living under Persia dominion. And Haman, the second in command to the king, tried to liquidate and exterminate all Jews. Isn't it interesting that this person picks Haman for his name? Anyway, Haman says this, this new crusade will not go unanswered as the previous one did. The crusade he's talking about is the burning of the books. The Abu Ghraib and other incidents, including this book burning, is not an act of a few foolish soldiers, but it is a continued organized attempt by the Zionists and the Western forces to inflame Muslims to justify their continued occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq. So he's telling us that this crusade is not going to go unanswered. Well, my friend, I'm going to be really frank with you, and I respect honest disagreement, but I don't respect you. So I'm going to talk to you in a language that you might understand better. You are talking like a mindless anti-Semite. The books were burned by accident. And are you as concerned when synagogues are burned? Who did you write to complain about synagogues being burned? Probably you didn't complain, not with a name like Haman. And when I hear about these Zionist conspiracies, I realize I am talking to somebody who makes the same kinds of comments that the Nazis and Ku Klux Klan make. And was that a threat we just heard from you, Haman? Is this your way of defending Islam as a religion of peace? Don't you go mistaking me for some politically correct enabler who feels the need to apologize for things he never did. If you think your threats are making me shake, then you must have sweet potato pie for brains. And that's as much as FCC regulations will allow me to articulate it. We'll be right back.
Website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
When the truth is found, to be realized, and all the joy within you dies. Don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody to love? Wouldn't you love somebody to love? You better find somebody to love.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Our theme, Christianity and its relationship to politics and pop culture. Probably enough politics for today, isn't it? Dana's here with me. It's always enough politics for Dana. Dana comes on and hosts the show with me sometimes, and other times she just sits and enjoys the show. She's such a faithful girlfriend. She loves the part of the show where I talk about the Bible. She hates the part of the show where I talk about politics, but she is faithful and supportive anyway. So I am going to switch gears, and I'm going to read something from the Sermon on the Mount. This is found in Matthew chapter 6, starting with verse 25. And this is sometimes posed as a question. It's sometimes posed as a comment. Is worry a sin? Now, we usually think of worry as a weakness. We think of worry as a struggler. And I want to say right from the beginning, worry is one of my own faults. Although it's interesting, and I think I inherited this from my dad, because my dad was the same way. My dad would get all bent out of shape over little things, but he'd be very calm when there's an emergency. And I think I've inherited that. If I could be on a plane, I fly a lot because of all the public speaking I do, that plane could suddenly nosedive and we can wonder if we're going to crash. And I'm just as calm as can be because I'm thinking, I'm not getting out of this easily. God still has work for me to do. When I die, I die. I don't worry about that. But I get some bill where they overcharge me or something, and it'll keep me up all night if it happens on a weekend and I can't get an operator on the phone. So throughout my life, I've worried a lot about little things or medium things, but not big things. So it's one of my flaws. I'll bet you didn't think I had any flaws. So I'm enlightening you. Write this day down where I tell you, no, of course I have many. This is one of them. So I relate to this, and I would say worry is a sin because it's something Jesus told us not to do, but I'm not saying that to put anybody on a guilt trip. If you're responding the way I first responded, when I first realized worry was a sin, I was relieved because I thought, well, if it's a sin to worry, then that must mean God doesn't want me to worry. Well, if God doesn't want me to worry, then maybe there's really nothing to worry about. You see, so it could be liberating. And okay, so what if it's a sin? Your sin was paid for on the cross by Jesus, right? Anyway, where does the Bible say that worry is a sin? Well, right where we said we were going to start, Matthew 6, starting with verse 25. Jesus talking, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food, and the body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? And why do you worry about your clothes? See how the lilies of the field grow? They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. So again, it's a sin because it's something he's telling us not to do. So if we do it, it's a sin. But can you see the compassion in Christ's words? Can you see how he cares about us? Now, there of course, are other places in the Bible that talk about worry. This is one of my favorite. They say it more briefly. This is the Apostle Paul talking. Philippians 4, 6 through 7. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Now, one important type of personal communication is God's peace. The opposite of peace is anxiety. Just as faith opens the door to God's peace, worry opens the door to greater frustration and turmoil. Isn't it interesting? They talk about making your petition known to God. It's funny, sometimes when people come to me in the many years that I was a pastor, and they're talking about prayer, human beings can always think of reasons to not pray. I spent some time with a good friend this weekend that I hadn't seen for a while, and he was here from out of town visiting me. Very dedicated Christian, but he said to me, and he's very blunt and very frank, he said, sometimes, Bob, I wonder what the purpose is of praying. Isn't God just going to do what he's going to do? And I said, well, you're partly right. God's going to do what he's going to do in the sense that he has this plan for you, this plan for the world, this plan for the cosmos. He's going to do what he's going to do. There's many different ways he could do it, and he wants to involve you in it. So he's going to do what he's going to do, but he's not going to do it a certain way particularly. Let me give you a cosmic example. That's twice I used the word cosmic now. I promise I won't use that word again. Sometimes I listen to these radio shows back, and I'm going to listen to this tomorrow on the recording. I'm going to go, why did you use the word cosmic twice? Maybe I should have said, let me give you a magnificent example from Scripture. An awesome example from Scripture. A fearsome, ferocious, all right, get on with it, Bob. Get on with it. All right, Moses. Okay, Moses. Actually, let's go back before Moses. Abraham, the patriarch of the Jewish faith. Abraham is told by God one day that he's going to have a son, even though his wife is in her 70s. And I know people lived longer in those days, but even in those days, a woman in her 70s was basically not able to bear children. So God says there's going to be a miracle, and your wife Sarah is going to give you a child. Sarah heard this. She actually heard God talking to Abraham. God came down in the form of a man. We call this a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. It's not only in the New Testament that we have this man who calls himself God. Sometimes in the Old Testament, God took on the form of a man. But Abraham realized he wasn't talking to a man, and he realized he wasn't seeing God as he truly looked. He realized that God was taken on a form so that he could relate to him. And God says, about this time next year, I'm going to visit you, and Sarah's going to have a son. Sarah's listening from the tent, and she laughs. Well, she had a son, just as God said, and they named him Isaac. You know what the name Isaac means? It means he laughed. It means God got the last laugh on Sarah. So who says God doesn't have a sense of humor? Sometimes you just have to know what those words mean. But he said to Abraham, it's not just that you're going to have a son. Said, you are going to have so many descendants, they're going to be as numerous as the sand on the seashore and the stars in the sky. Now, one of Abraham's descendants, many years later, hundreds of years later, in fact, was Moses. And you know the story of Moses. You even know what he looks like. He looks just like Charlton Heston. So you even know what he looks like. But don't take too much from Hollywood, because I know when you watch the Ten Commandments, you're watching it in color. And of course, they didn't have color film in those days, only black and white film. So obviously that was colorized. So anyway, but through Moses, the children of Israel leave Egypt and they're in the wilderness. And Moses goes on top of the mountain to get the law. And the people start whining and they start rebelling against God. And they build this golden calf and they start worshiping it. By the way, you know, when people worship those golden calves, they weren't as stupid as you think they are. You're thinking, how could they worship something that they just built? No. When they built a golden calf, they thought they were building a representation of what some god in heaven looked like. And when they would look at the sickle of the moon, well, I guess they were partly stupid because they didn't understand astronomy like we do today, but they would look at the sickle of the moon, it would be shaped a little bit like a cow's horn or a ram's horn. That's why they tended to worship those kinds of animals. Anyway, this will lead us back to the subject of worry, and I'm going to tell you the very interesting thing that happened to Moses when God showed that our prayer does matter.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Welcome back to our program. Okay, so we left off talking about Moses. The children of Israel are rebelling against God, worshiping the golden calf. God says to Moses, I'm going to wipe out, I'm going to destroy this entire nation. Now, if my friend was correct when he said, well, God's just going to do what he's going to do, well, it doesn't look that way, because God said that through Abraham, he was going to have as many descendants as the sand on the seashore and the stars in the sky. Well, how could that happen if he destroys them all? Because Moses is a descendant of Abraham. Moses and his wife and his kids, God could have destroyed all the Israelites like he said he was going to do and jump-started the Israelite race through Moses and still kept this promise to Abraham, because if just as many descendants came through Moses, they belonged to Abraham too, because Moses goes back to Abraham. So God has different ways of doing it. Now, Moses said something that you wouldn't expect someone to say to a God. He says, God, you just delivered the people out of Egypt. All the nations are talking about it. What about your reputation? What do you want them to do? Say, oh, yeah, this God, what a cruel God, what a vindictive God. He brought them out of Egypt just to destroy them. He says, Lord, destroy me instead. It was almost like what Jesus did. Lord, kill me. Let my brethren live. God says, okay, I won't destroy them because you prayed. Now, I know, and I've been to seminary, and I know how theologians look at this, and they say, well, the Spirit of God was living through Moses. And the Spirit of God encouraged Moses to make that prayer. Moses was only making the prayer that God wanted him to make. This was really God's will. You know what? When you just read the text without any preconceived ideas, it doesn't seem to be saying that. Sometimes all we have to do is read it. I am convinced that if Moses hadn't made that prayer, God would have destroyed the people because of their disobedience. And Moses made the prayer, and he made a difference. So prayer makes a difference. Let me read that again from Philippians. Philippians 4, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. Petition. When they used that word petition, they were talking about the kind of petition that somebody would bring before a king. Those of you that are in college, imagine you got into trouble at the university over something, but you had an opportunity to go and talk to the school chancellor, just you and him in his office. He's going to give you complete 100% undivided time. Those of you that are out of college, imagine you got in trouble with the law, but you didn't think it was your fault. Or maybe it was your fault, but you want to throw yourself on the mercy of the court. You want to explain the circumstances. And the judge says, I'm going to make some time. You can come into my chambers and take as much time as you want to explain it to me. Now, you still may not be sure what they're going to decide, but wouldn't you walk out of there going, boy, I gave it my best shot. I did everything I could possibly do. If this judge in the court has heard me out, or if this chancellor at the university has heard me out, you know, I've got a pretty good chance. Well, the God of the universe, higher than any judge, higher than any chancellor, not just the God of planet Earth, but the God of every galaxy, the God of every universe, every dimension, wants to listen to you. And then you go, oh, well, he's too busy. God is omnipresent. I don't mean God is everything. That's an Eastern view that God, I'm not saying God is the universe. God created the universe, but he's omnipresent in the sense that his presence can be everywhere. He can hear you. Well, he's busy. I mean, there's earthquakes, there's famine, there's drought, there's pestilence, there's wars, there's stuff going on in the United Nations. He can give you 100% undivided time and give somebody else 100% undivided time. Some of you, when you get to heaven, you're going to be surprised and pleasantly surprised, but also regretful of the personal relationship you could have had with God in this life. He loves to give you that time. You can talk to him. He will listen for as long as you want to talk. And when you're done talking to him, his Spirit who lives inside of you, and if you've given your life to God, if you've accepted the forgiveness of Jesus and dedicated your life, his Spirit lives inside of you. If you haven't done that, I don't want to leave you out, because you can do that at any time. Go to God and say, forgive me my sins. The Bible means selfishness when it says sins. I know I define my terminology a lot on this show, but I know that not everybody who listens to this show is a Christian, so I don't want to have closed house discussions. I want to include everybody who's listening. You can have that relationship with God at any time. But if you have that relationship and you pray, there's this peace that comes over you from his Spirit. And that's the way they describe it here in Philippians. The peace which transcends all understanding will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. What a comforting thought. Now, as I told you before, I grew up as a real worrywart. I wasn't a hypochondriac. I wasn't one who always thought he was sick, but worried a lot about little things, and yet surprisingly very calm when big things happen to me. I can be out on a campus and somebody might not like some of the things I'm saying about Christianity. I could have angry people. I've had several angry people yell and scream at me at one time. I don't even flinch, but like I said, I get some phone bill that looks like they overcharge me, or you know, something. Little things just annoy the you-know-what out of me. And I grew up worrying about a lot of things. I grew up in the 60s, so of course one thing we were all concerned about was the draft. I worried about getting drafted because I would have made a – I didn't really know how I felt about war. I actually these days have a great respect for the military. But when I was in high school, I could think about was that I'd make the worst soldier in the world. I couldn't aim with a gun for the life of me. I'm not mechanically inclined. I don't know what I would have done in the Army except work in a kitchen or something. But I worried and worried and worried about the draft, and then they ended the draft in 73. And look at those years I wasted worrying it. And then I would always worry about going bald, even though baldness doesn't run in my family. I'm 58 years old. I still have a thick head of hair. It's partly gray, but it's still even got a lot of dark in it, too. And look, I mean, I ought to be bald just from all the anxiety and worrying about it. But So I grew up worrying about these things, but according to Jesus, worry is a sin. Why? Well, it's a sin because it shows a lack of trust. It's a sin because it shows blindness, because we're not understanding what God wants to do to us. He's saying, look around. Look at the lilies of the field. Look how I take care of even the plants and the birds. Can't you see? Are you blind? And it's because it's needless. He says, by worrying, can we really add anything to our lives anyway? Now, the Greek word for worry that he was using here meant to divide, to rip, to tear apart. Don't you just feel that way in your gut when you are worried? How can worry obstruct your relationship with God? Well, it's interesting. A couple of years ago, well, this is still a popular movement, but the movement began a few years ago. It's called The Secret by a woman named Rhonda Byrne. If you're into that, there's another book you ought to read called The Secret Revealed by Jim Garlow. I was one of the researchers for that book, but the author is Jim Garlow. He had a co-author too, whose name escapes me at the moment, but I should mention that he had a co-author as well. But The Secret was based on this idea that if you think positive, positive things will happen to you. And of course, a lot of times people will experience that. They think positive and positive things happen. They think negative and negative things happen. Doesn't always work that way. During the Holocaust in Nazi Germany, a lot of rabbis in the synagogues just said, think positive, this will pass over. So sometimes we can be naive and not warn people about evil, and we just think positive instead. But the problem with The Secret, and when I've critiqued The Secret, people said, oh, so you don't believe in positive thinking? No, I do believe in positive thinking. And I freely admit that as one who worries easily, I have a lot to learn about positive thinking. But in The Secret, they also have a theology that goes with the positive thinking. I mentioned earlier that a lot of people today think that God and the universe are one and the same thing. That's what they say in The Secret, that when you think positive, your thought vibrations get into connection with the thought vibrations of the universe, and then the universe will make what you want happen. Okay. All right. Well, here's the thing. The Bible talks about positive thinking too. But the Bible gives a different reason why it's happening. Again, God and the universe are not the same thing. God is not the tree. God is not the forest. God made the tree. God made the forest. God made the universe. But the Bible does tell us that there's a spiritual warfare going on. And I'll need to come back and explain spiritual warfare in more detail. But it is true that when we don't have faith and we have negative thoughts, some of these creatures that live in another dimension, these demonic beings, gain a little bit of power based on our lack of faith. So sometimes the things we worry about can actually happen. We can stage things. When I go to a movie, I know somebody's going to kick my seat. Probably they're kicking my seat because I know somebody's going to kick my seat. There could even be some little demon that's just needling somebody to do that. When I go to fast food, my friends always joke, don't go to a restaurant with Bob because he's the guy whose food they'll make the wrong way. I remember one time I went to Burger King and I ordered my plain chicken sandwich. Plain means plain. Means I don't want it slopped with mayo. And some dude gives it to me. And of course, Murphy's Law applies there too. The longer it takes them to give you your order, the more it proportionally increases the odds that they'll make it wrong when they finally give it to you. So sure enough, after I've waited 30 minutes, he hands me this thing slopped with mayo. I said, I ordered it plain. He looks at me and goes, oh. So, what do you want me to do? I said, well, I'd like you to make it again and do it right. But it finally occurred to me that maybe because I'm expecting that to happen, that's why it's happening. Not because of that nonsense in the secret, but because of the truth about spiritual warfare that they talk about in the Bible. Well, more of this on a future program. We will see you then. You are always welcome. Your questions are welcome, too.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.